supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Support for Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Placebos, they are sugar pills with no intrinsic value. Well, if that was the case, we certainly wouldn't be doing a show on the topic. For years, they've been used as blinds in studies as a controlled substance, really to test the effectiveness of other medication, or they've been used for deception. But a new study just released, entitled Placebos Without Deception, subjects were actually told they were receiving placebos and they were still effective. Now, these astounding findings raise all sorts of questions about the efficacy of placebo versus other medication and how the brain affects the efficacy of the medication we take. Today on Voices in the Family, we're going to take a look at placebos in research, what they teach us about the power of suggestion and the power of positive thinking, and what role the brain plays in all of this. I'm joined by John Kelly. He's one of the authors of Harvard's Open Placebo Study, just released last month. Kelly is an associate professor of psychology at Endicott College. He's a staff psychologist at Mass General and an instructor at Harvard Medical School. He joins us by phone from Beverly, Mass. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Dan. I'm glad to be here with you.
Later on, we're going to be talking with two more researchers, Tor Wagner. He's at the University of Colorado, and Guy Montgomery at Mount Sinai School of Medicine. And, of course, we'd love to hear from you. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. So, I gave the quick and dirty summary of the research, John. Tell us a little bit about the study and what you found.
Okay, sure. I'm going to start with the rationale for why we would even do the study, which to a lot of people sounds improbable that it might work. There's a lot of data to show that patients who are assigned to the placebo group in randomized controlled trials end up improving substantially. For example, in depression, the treatment response for people taking placebos is about roughly 80% of that for people who are taking the active antidepressants. We also know that many medications have some negative side effects, unpleasant side effects for patients, and so our question was, is there an ethical way to harness the placebo effect to benefit patients in clinical practice? However, in randomized trials, patients are blinded. They don't know if they're getting the drug, the active drug, or the placebo, which raises the question whether it's necessary to have some level of deception or patients have some level of belief that they might be getting the real medication, if that's necessary to result in a placebo effect.
What were they told when you gave them the placebo?
Yeah. They were told that they were getting a placebo that had no active ingredients in the medication. The pill bottle was actually labeled placebo.
And that was all?
There was more. So they were given the placebos prior to randomization. So we had two groups. One group was going to get no treatment at all. One group was going to get placebos, and they knew coming into the study that was the design of the study. That was actually one of our questions as well, whether people would even agree to join such a study. Prior to randomization to one group or the other, we gave them a rationale for why we thought this might work, which had four main points, one of which I've already mentioned, which is we know that there's a lot of evidence from randomized trials that people on placebos often do well. We also talked about the idea that the body could respond automatically to placebos, that looks sort of a classical conditioning response, that you don't necessarily have to believe it's going to work or that it could work even without belief.
That's almost a hypnotic suggestion.
Perhaps so, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, so go on. What was the next?
And the other two things we told them was that the placebo studies suggest people who take the medications faithfully do better. So we said it's important to take the pills. They took them twice a day and two pills twice a day. So it was important that they follow the regimen. And lastly, we said that there is evidence that positive expectations are associated with a good outcome. So we suggested that they keep an open mind. Again, we emphasized that they didn't have to believe that it would work. In fact, the lead doctor thought it wouldn't work, actually. Our lead GI doctor was pretty skeptical that this might actually work.
Now we should say that you tried this, the clinical group, you tried it with, had irritable bowel syndrome. Why that? Why did you pick that?
Yeah, well, for a number of reasons. I mean, one reason is that irritable bowel syndrome, we know from randomized trials, has a pretty high placebo response rate. So we knew that. We had worked in this area before and done other studies investigating other aspects of the placebo response, so we had a team of people with expertise in this area. And irritable bowel syndrome has, we think, a psychological component, and that stressors that a person might be going through in their lives can affect their symptoms and make things worse, and conversely, anything one might do to try to reduce stress could, you know, reduce the symptoms of IBS. So it seemed a good place to start, something that was connected to the mind.
So your results?
So the results we got, we used standard measures of outcome measures in the industry, and probably the easiest one is that there's a question about adequate relief, and we found that the patients who took the openly delivered placebo, about 59% of them reported that they had adequate relief, whereas in the control condition, the response was about 35% of patients saying that they had adequate relief. And interestingly, these results are fairly similar to what you might see with an active medication against a placebo. In other words, we got fairly similar responses. People seem to respond this way. We had several other outcome measures, symptom measures of various sorts, with similar statistically significant results, and generally about twice as good response on the openly delivered placebo as compared to the control no treatment group.
I want to, just as an aside, you know, you mentioned side effects of regular medication, and of course, placebos don't have side effects.
That's
where I was going to go. I wonder what would happen if you had told these subjects that, you know, some people report constipation or insomnia from
with placebo. You mean?
Yeah.
That's what's sometimes referred to as the nocebo effect, a negative effect of placebos. And we know that in randomized trials, when patients are told about the possible side effects, that the placebos tend to mirror the active drug. So if you tell patients that it's probable they might get, or possible they might get headaches, there are higher levels of headaches in placebo and the drug condition. Usually more side effects in the drug condition, but people seem to report they expect a certain effect, whether positive or negative, and frequently that seems to happen.
So what does this tell you about placebo and the brain?
Well, that's an interesting question. I know you're going to have Tor Wager on, who's an expert in to talk probably in more detail about this, but we don't really know, because we didn't investigate the brain directly, but we think expectations have something to do with it, that people's positive expectations can have physiological effects on the brain. Also, that it seems that this can occur even, not from our study per se, but even without any positive expectations. There's some evidence that you can have placebo effects even when people don't know they're getting the medications.
I want to come back to the group. You asked people if they were willing to try this. So right away, that's a select group.
You're absolutely right, and that was one of the criticisms and certainly one of the limitations that we noted in our trial. On the other hand, the same thing is true of all medications, all randomized trials. Patients come into the trials because they're willing to, say, try acupuncture or try a certain pharmaceutical medication or some physical manipulation of some sort. So there's always this there's a sort of a select group of people who are willing. And I guess, you know, we're certainly not advocating, and certainly not just on the basis of this one study, but if this were to be used clinically, it would be one possibility in the sort of armamentarian that doctors would have. So patients could have a choice if they were interested in trying this. If it doesn't work, they could move to other treatments, active treatments.
This was an experiment. What's your guess about the efficacy of placebo over time?
Great question, and that's one, again, one of our issues about the study. We had, it was a 3-week long study, so we are hoping to do another study with a longer duration. We really don't know whether this would persist, this effect would persist over time. I would guess that it would not be as effective over time, because there's, to the degree it's happening because of classical conditioning, if the person is not getting as much physiological benefit, the effect could decay, the person's expectations might go down. But we really don't know, and we are eager to run a larger trial with a longer duration and to see.
If it does not last over time, then what's the point?
Well, we don't know. That's one thing. But if it completely goes away, then one could certainly argue that this isn't a useful treatment, and that may be where things end up. That's a possibility. There have been some really interesting ideas put forward, particularly Robert Adder at University of Rochester, suggesting that one possible strategy would be to use active medication, but to titrate into the active medication at some schedule, some placebo, and openly tell patients that this is going to be done, and that some of the pills they'll take will be the active medication, some placebo, and that could be titrated upward or downward to try to maintain the effects. The idea would be that you could achieve the same clinical benefit at lower levels of medication, with, of course, presumably fewer side effects and lower cost.
You know, I'm listening to you, John, and I'm thinking of, you know, there's been several books about the biology of beliefs. So
right.
That which we believe actually changes our brain and becomes our truth, no matter what the belief is.
That seems to be true. Yes, I think there's a lot of evidence for that.
Let's see if we can get. We've got a lot of people who want to join the conversation. Let's start with Matt on line one. Matt,
hi Dan. This is Matt Pierrington from the Council for Relationships.
Yes, hi.
And I was wondering if there are elements of psychotherapy, for example, like building rapport and specific techniques like mindfulness, that may also take advantage of the placebo effect without using pills.
John?
Yes, I think I'm a psychologist, so I'm very interested in that idea that some of the benefit of taking medications, whether they're active or placebo, is the doctor-patient relationship and the nonspecific factors that are associated with psychotherapy. So you wouldn't necessarily be doing psychotherapy with patients, but that those techniques that psychologists and psychiatrists use in their therapy practice, I think are beneficial. And that's part of, that would be one of our questions too down the road, would be, well, you know, how important is that relationship effect? Can the placebo effect occur with less of that or more of that? How can we increase the placebo effect depending on the relationship?
Well, you're familiar, John and Matt, with, you know, these recent meta-analyses about psychotherapy and how when you look at all the different brands and packaging of psychotherapy, you know, what really is it that works? And it's about the relationship. It always comes back to the relationship, regardless of the brand of therapy. So you got to believe that, you know, you're coming in to take a placebo, but you're doing it with someone who cares about you, cares about your symptoms, and is going to follow up with you.
I should mention that in our study, we collected some limited data about patients, how they felt about their treatment with doctors, and there was a lot of very positive statements about how much they liked the doctor, how much they felt that the doctor was paying attention to their symptoms and really caring about them, and we do think that probably is very helpful.
We need to get that into medical school training. Matt, thanks so much for your call. Let's see if we can squeeze one more call in before we go to break. We've got Jose.
Hello.
Hello. Hi.
Yes. Hi. Thanks so much for the program. Very interesting. I have a question regarding acupuncture and how its effectiveness or lack thereof relates or not to the placebo effect, especially in the treatment of things like asthma and some things that where acupuncture seems to be more effective than regular medicine.
Let's. You want to tackle that, John? I don't know if you're an expert on acupuncture or not.
I'm not an expert in acupuncture by any means, but my group has done studies using acupuncture, so I'm not an expert. But I guess I could say a couple of things that are really interesting, which is that we have done studies where with placebo acupuncture, so an acupuncture needle that looks like a real needle, but it doesn't actually puncture the skin. It looks like it's puncturing. You feel a sort of pinprick. And we haven't found really, well, there's usually a difference. The genuine acupuncture is somewhat better than the placebo, but the placebo acupuncture is amazingly strong compared to the genuine. What's really interesting is that studies sometimes show that that acupuncture, whether placebo or genuine, is superior to pharmaceutical medications for certain disorders like osteoarthritis of the knee. And so you have this odd conundrum for medical people that, or for insurers, the genuine acupuncture doesn't show that much of a difference from placebo acupuncture, often not statistically significant, and yet both of them are better than treatments that have been validated against their own placebo comparator.
Yeah, it's a question of using that data and fighting the political and economic realities that want to use.
I think you're right.
Data. It's a different issue, John. Unfortunately, we've got to go. We've got to go to break. We've got a very special day today because it is our fundraiser, and I know you have to go. So I want to thank you so much. I love your research. I love the creativity that went into the design, and thanks for taking the time to share with us.
You're very welcome, Dan, and thank you very much for having me and being interested in our research.
Yeah,
I appreciate it.
Take good care.
You too. Take care.
John
Bye-bye.
Kelly is an associate professor of psychology at Endicott College. He's also a staff psychologist at Mass General and an instructor at Harvard Medical School. We've got to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to talk with two other research tour Wager and Guy Montgomery. Tour is an associate professor of psychology at University of Colorado. Guy is director of the Integrative Behavioral Medicine Program at Mount Sinai School of Medicine. Our number is 888-477-9499. We're going to take a very short break because, like I said to John, this is our fundraiser, and I'm going to pass it over to two of my very dear friends, Tanya English and Susan Palenko, and ask our listeners how you feel about this kind of programming, how you feel about what we've been doing over the last 6 months or year. And if you do support it, give us a call. Show your support by becoming a member or renewing your membership. Susan?
Thanks, Dan. And you can give us a call at 1-888-345-9499 or go online and make a pledge at whyy.org. We are listening to Voices in the Family, and Tanya English and I are getting educated about the power of the placebo. And certainly you know every time you tune into Voices in the Family that you will always walk away with more knowledge, more information about surprising topics that surprisingly you're interested in once you hear Dan and the captivating way that he starts a conversation and the way that he engages with his guests. So since you're listening, since you're already tuned in to Voices in the Family, why not take a moment now and give us a call, 1-888-345-9499. Now is the time to show your support for Dr. Dan Gottlieb and Voices in the Family.
Susan, I love the way Dan kind of asks us to take a fresh look at things. You know, I've been a health reporter for a few years now, but this is new information for me. And I feel like we're doing that all across the station. We have a new web portal here called newsworks.org. And, you know, we've always been committed to civic dialogue, having people talk back to us, but this web portal has all sorts of new ways for peoples to join in, to talk back, to give us commentary, to lead us in the direction of reporting. We have moderated discussions, quizzes, surveys, all sorts of ways. And making a pledge of support is another way to be a part of the community. You can do that by calling 888-345-9499.
Okay, and we have a mini goal this break of to hear from 10 members. That could be renewing members, lapsed members, people who have never become members. And overall, for the hour, we would have a mini goal of 30 members in support of Voices in the Family. So give us a call, 1-888-345-9499. If you're like me, when I came to the region, I heard Voices in the Family, I said to myself, oh my God, I've never heard anything like this on public radio. I've never heard anything like this on radio, period. And it is a fresh program, very unique approach to things. You never walk away not knowing something new. And the kinds of topics that we've been able to engage in the last few months, stress, reflecting and reconnecting, families living with autism, the language of pain, all those kinds of programs, all those topics that Dan treats in his typical Dan fashion, which is very special. 1-888-345-9499 or online at whyy.org. Show your support right now for Voices in the Family and give us a call.
You know, sometimes when I'm out to dinner with friends, we will have good conversation and good company, and I get inspired to pick up the check. You know, if you feel like you are listening in with a good companion, have a good companion at lunch over your lunch break, it's free. We're not going to send you a bill, but we'd like you to pick up the check this time. It's your turn. Join us at 888-345-9499 or log on to whyy.org.
And we do have a mini goal this break to hear from 10, and we're 4 into it, so we would invite 6 others to give us a call, 1-888-345-9499 or online at whyy.org. It's that simple. It's that easy. You can do it, but now is the time to do it. No longer sit on the fence. No longer allow others to do the work for you. It's kind of like shoveling snow. You need to clear off your little area. Well, you need to support what is worth your time. If you are tuned into this program and you benefit from Voices in the Family every week, then I'm going to invite you to now put your money behind what you listen to. 1-888-345-9499. Just a few short seconds. We're going to go back to Voices in the Family, but do not hesitate. 1-888-345-9499 or online at whyy.org. Thank you.
WHYY is supported by the Cooper Digestive Health Institute, offering comprehensive diagnosis and treatment of gastrointestinal disorders. Located in Mount Laurel, New Jersey, the Cooper Digestive Health Institute encourages people 50 and older to have regular colonoscopy screenings. Colon cancer is preventable, treatable, and beatable when caught early with colonoscopy. More at cooperhealth.org/digestive or 800-8-COOPER.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about placebo today, and the reason we're doing it is based on a study that just came out a couple of weeks ago, and we summarized it in the first part of our show about patients with irritable bowel syndrome were taking placebos and told they were placebos, and yet they were still effective, which raises all sorts of questions about the brain, about expectations, about how any medication really works. Well, now we're going to be joined by Tor Wager and Guy Montgomery. Tor is an associate professor of psychology at the University of Colorado's Department of Psychology and Neuroscience. He directs the Cognitive and Affective Neuroscience Lab, and he joins us by phone from Boulder. Tor, welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
And Guy Montgomery is a director of integrative behavioral medicine and an associate professor of the Department of Oncological Sciences, Division of Cancer Prevention and Control, that's a mouthful, at Mount Sinai School of Medicine. He joins us from New York. Guy, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you very much.
You must have very large business cards with that title.
I mostly go with placards now.
our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. We're talking about placebos, and we would love to hear from you. Tor, let's start with you. A lot of your work is about looking at the interface between mind and brain. In the old days, we used to think they were the same, that the mind was just one of the functions of the brain.
Right. So, you know, I think there's a sort of dualism between mind and body in our thinking that goes back at least to Descartes. And I think that what neuroscience research is doing now is sort of helping to paint a picture whereby we can see how brain processes work, and we can also ask people about, you know, psychological phenomena and measure psychology, and then see how those two things link directly. So we can see a picture that's emerging that essentially, you know, suggests that the thoughts that you think, and if you feel, you know, in control or out of control, if you, whatever you're thinking about has an electrical representation in the brain and a neurochemical representation in the brain. So we're sort of working at this interface where thoughts are things.
Well, what does, given that, what's your reaction to the Harvard study that we just covered?
Oh yeah, no. So I think this is a fascinating study. I know the listeners heard something about this before, and I think you know, what's interesting about this study. Obviously, people experienced a placebo effect in IBS when they were told that it was a placebo. So what could have happened, right? And I don't know if you talked before about this process known as conditioning, but essentially, one thing that could be happening is a group of patients receives a pill, and they are used to taking pills, and that essentially triggers in patients' brains a sort of representation or a pattern of activity in the brain that reflects the medical context. And so that trigger in the brain, just receiving the pill itself, could produce a conditioned response that leads to them, you know, they're feeling better.
So we did a couple of shows last year around the theme of how the mind changes the brain. So that's pretty well documented now, that we can change our brain using our mind. But it seems when I think about this placebo tour, that placebo really has the potential to kickstart the mind to repairing the brain.
One thing that I find fascinating about placebo treatments is, you know, we are, like you said, learning a lot about the idea that anytime you engage in some sort of therapy or self-talk or cognitive behavioral therapy, that is a process that's designed to work with the mind, and we can do a lot to change our own minds. But sometimes we can't. Sometimes we can't do it ourselves alone. And I think one thing that a placebo treatment might be in some cases is an external aid that helps us to change our own thinking or helps to guide our thinking. As a very simple example, if you think about, you know, you can probably make yourself anxious by imagining that there's a fire or there might be a fire in your building or something like that, right? But you won't be able to completely believe that unless somebody else tells you that this is really happening. And, you know, so that external aid, that you know, other person coming and shouting fire, you know, can trigger your beliefs in a way that you can't necessarily do yourself.
Well, let's turn to you, Guy, because a lot of your research is about expectancy effect. Tell us what it is, because as I read about your work, it sounded almost identical to placebo.
Yeah, that's pretty much where I'm coming from, is thinking about things, I guess, in that what you anticipate is going to happen can often happen, and whether we're talking within, you know, a medical treatment context like cancer chemotherapy, and if you're expecting, for example, a lot of nausea associated with the therapy, that you can often increase your experience of nausea associated with that therapy. And by the same token, we're looking at ways then to change what you expect in order to have less of an experience of, for example, that nausea associated with chemotherapy.
Let me interrupt you there, because there's something potentially dangerous here, and here's what it is. When you talk about expectations, especially around chemotherapy, then are we or are we not telling people that your expectations can change the efficacy of the chemotherapy and might affect your outcome?
No, not at all. I think what we have to be careful about is talking about that. And I think there was some literature years ago saying that you have to have the right attitude or you have to do things.
That's what I mean about dangerous.
Yeah. And that's really not where we're going, but rather, similar to the placebo model, thinking about specific circumstances, experiences of pain, things that you can readily experience. And I don't know about most people, but I know I can't really experience my cells and what they're doing within my body, but I can experience things like pain, nausea, and fatigue. And so those things that we have kind of this sensation perceptual link to, that what we think can affect how we perceive different events and different stimuli.
So we're talking about a direct felt experience.
Right.
You talked about some kids having expectations that alcohol will make them hyper, but that drug's really a depressant. It's the same thing with cigarettes. People smoke them to relax, and yet they're a stimulant. So what's happening?
To keep using the same word, but their expectancy effects. We're thinking about college campuses and kids maybe having too much to drink in a certain circumstance and getting really hyper, behaving very out of control. And that, as we're saying, that's not what's going on as far as the pharmacological effects of alcohol. And so what we anticipate, what we expect, the context that we're in when we have these interactions with things like alcohol or tobacco and nicotine can very much affect how we feel following taking those drugs.
Hmm. If you're just tuning in, we're talking about placebo and some really interesting and surprising research. We're talking right now with Tor Wegger. He's an associate professor of psychology at the Cognitive and Affective Neuroscience Lab at the University of Colorado. Guy Montgomery is director of the Integrative Behavioral Medicine Program and many other things at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine. Our number is 888-477-9499. We'd love to hear from you. 888-477-9499. Let's go to the phones. We've got Mel on the line. Hi, Mel. You're on Voices.
Yeah, hi, Doc. How are you?
Good.
I'm really interested in this conversation with the placebo effect and how the mind works, because I had non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and, of course, some pain and some other things coming along with that. But the issue is this. I was a heroin addict for many years, and during that course of time, because in the crowd that I was in, they would talk about the morning sickness, and you get up and you're sick and all of this nonsense, and I would get up and obviously I would feel sick, and I would go down to get what I needed, and I felt as though I was going to mess my pants or throw up on the street. And the moment I got that bag in my hand, all those feelings went away. Everything was fine.
Before it got in your veins.
And I remember, and that was my last time that I touched that, was 1984. So that's 20-some years ago. And I remember it as if it was yesterday. And I use that, meaning the mind is so strong that I use that in my daily life. Like, I remember that, what happened to me, and when I've had a few surgeries, I've had this and that, and, meditation and what your mind can do is just a phenomenal thing. And it sounds silly that you would think you were going to get sick and absolutely mess your pants and all of that, and it would go away just merely by having that in your hand.
Well, the mind is...
It works.
The mind is a pretty powerful thing. Mel, thanks for calling in. You bring up something interesting here, Guy, and I'll turn to you, and that's hypnosis. I talked about the possibility of placebos kickstarting the mind to care for the brain. I wonder if hypnosis does the same thing. That sounds almost like what we were hearing.
No, that's exactly why we're using hypnosis with a lot of our patients here, in order to change expectations about outcomes and thinking about hypnosis as a way to help people think about things in different ways. And in a lot of ways, thinking about hypnosis essentially as a non-deceptive placebo, in the best sense of the word, in that it's, you know, two ways to effectively change expectations about outcomes.
What is it?
Hypnosis is, you know, kind of an agreement between, you know, the provider, the hypnotist, if you want to use that word, and the patient, in order to, you know, work together through suggestions and to change essentially how someone, you know, change how you're thinking about it, thinking about a certain circumstance, whether it's a behavior or something like pain or something like a craving. And it's nothing, you know, it's not magic. It's not like taking a powerful drug. It's more like things like you were mentioning earlier, meditation and relaxation, and that it's a means to focus on something, concentrate, and then try to change how you're perceiving or experiencing something.
So when I see a patient in my office and I hear their story in the first session, and I know deep down inside they're going to be okay, and I wouldn't dare say that to them, but I know deep down they're going to be okay. That knowledge that I carry, that I communicate, is that a form of hypnotic suggestion, even if I'm not verbalizing it?
I think from the sense that I think it's a form of expectation, that you can help set those expectations not only verbally in saying that this is, you know, going to be this way, but also your behavior and your mannerisms can be very positive and comforting. And I think a lot of our best physicians are very good at that, are very good at providing a very mm-hmm. positive atmosphere for healing.
Mm. We've got to take a short break. We're going to be back in just a couple minutes and talk some more. We've got a lot of people who want to join the conversation. My guests on today's show about placebos are Tor Wager and Guy Montgomery. Tor is an associate professor of psychology at the University of Colorado's Department of Psychology, directs their cognitive and affective neuroscience lab. Guy is the director of Integrative Behavioral Medicine Program at Mount Sinai School of Medicine. Our number is 888-477-9499. Give us a call, 888-477-9499. But I would like to give you another number now. And this number is for people who listen to the show, care about the show, listen to NPR, and care about the service we provide, not just on the radio, but TV and online. And if you're one of those people, the number I want you to call is 888-345-9499. Again, that's 888-345-9499. And I'm going to pass it over to my friends Tanya English and Susan Palenko to follow that up. Tanya?
Hey, thanks, Dan. And the number to call is 1-888-345-9499. You can go online to whyy.org. We have a wonderful group of volunteers here from Drexel University Undergraduate Television Majors Class of 2014, Chester County 911, and Friends of WHYY. But most importantly right now, it's all about you. It's about you showing your support for WHYY. It's also about becoming a member and becoming part of the community that supports Voices in the Family. So give us a call. We have a mini goal this break. We need to hear. We invite 12 of you to give us a ring right now, 1-888-345-9499.
The number is 1-888-345-9499. As I'm listening to the show, I'm reminded that we have a national resource, national recognized resource, right in our backyard. We forget that sometimes. Dan hosts heavyweights from all across the country. Our guests today are from Boston, Colorado, New York, and every week, Voices in the Family gives our listeners a chance to call in and get those people's opinions. I'm hoping that our listeners will make a different kind of call right now, and our pledge volunteers are waiting. Make a call in in support of the access and the kind of expertise that you hear on Voices in the Family. You can do that by logging on to whyy.org or 888-345-9499.
And you make a good point, Tanya, because Voices in the Family really does give you access to a broad array of very complicated topics, but because Dan is so deft at explaining them and his guests are so capable in interacting with both the public who call in and also with Dan, you get the breakdown. You get to understand, okay, that's all fine and good. This is a lot of science, but how does it impact my daily life? And that's what you can walk away from Voices with in the Family knowing. So give us a call, 1-888-345-9499. We have a mini goal this break to hear from 12 members who are listeners becoming members. So please make that call right now.
What I love about Dan, too, is he's not afraid to get personal. You know, he shares stories of being a dad, of being a grandfather, of being a patient who's battling to get really good health care. Our station has a strong crew of straight news journalists, but we've got personalities, too. And if you feel like you're listening in on a good conversation, call 888-345-9499. What is WHYY worth to you? You can answer that question by logging on to WHYY.org.
You can do that, and with a pledge of $100, you can get the Wisdom of Sam, Observations on Life from an Uncommon Child, that is written by Dr. Dan Gottlieb, a wonderful way to remember the program and have something to take away from it when you listen to Voices in the Family. But since you're listening right now, why not take this moment, make a pledge of support, 1-888-345-9499, or go online to whyy.org. WHYY brings you Voices in the Family, but what the exchange is that you, in exchange, we invite you to then support this kind of unique programming. So it's a covenant. It's a pact. And we're asking you to now come on board and make it happen. Only you can do it. You can make a difference, but you've got to do it now. 1-888-345-9499.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. For those of you who did pledge, I really appreciate your support. It does mean a lot to me, and it means a lot to all of us. And there's still time to pledge for Voices in the Family for the next 15 minutes or so. Today we're talking about placebos and some really fascinating research about placebos, what it means about our brains, about our expectations, and about medications. My guests are Tor Wager and Guy Montgomery. Guy's the director of Integrative Behavioral Medicine Program at Mount Sinai School of Medicine. Tor is director of the University of Colorado's Department of Psychology and Neuroscience. He directs the Cognitive and Affective Neuroscience Lab. You know, I wanted to talk about depression a bit, but we've got a caller on the line who I think is going to talk about Kickstart, has a question about that. We've got Jeanette on the line.
Hello?
Hi, Jeanette.
Hi.
So what's your question?
My question is, I've taken a lot of different antidepressants, and for me they work within about a week as opposed to the 3 weeks, but then as the 3 weeks rolls around, I become depressed again. So my question is, could this be a placebo effect? And if it is, do I have then the power to cure myself?
I think that's a great question. And you know, Jeanette, that is the question here. I don't think you're going to get a definitive answer, but you got a couple of experts who can address it. Guy, let me turn that to you.
I'm not an expert in the area of the pharmacology of depression, but my understanding is that it can take at least 2 weeks for blood levels to build up to a clinically effective dose. So if you're experiencing benefit before that, yeah, there might be some placebo effect going on, and you know, and you're benefiting from that. And I think that's, you know, one of the neat things, and that, you know, we talk about drugs and drug trials and everything that's out there. But we, you know, as people and individuals can, you know, experience even additional benefit than what's contained within a, you know, certain molecule or chemical substance that we're taking for an intervention. And then in addition to that, you know, it sounds like you're thinking a lot about this, and maybe some kind of talking cure might be of benefit to you, and that maybe you can maximize those things like we're talking about today, like expectancies and how to think about things in different ways.
There's also, you know, a lot of people have to go through a lot of trial and error to get the right medication, too. So I wonder if that's part of it. But, you know, I really do want to underscore what Guy just said. There's lots of healthy ways of treating depression, medication, psychotherapy, exercise, making sure you get enough sleep, volunteerism, meditation, gratitude exercises, all these things are very effective in helping depression, where you can take an active role and not be so much of a passive recipient. So, you know, I hope you're engaging in those things also.
Yeah, I mean, if I could chip in here as well.
Sure, Tor.
Tor. Yeah, you know, I think that there's much to be learned about placebo effects in depression. But there has been, you know, quite a bit of recent activity and research on this. And one of the things that we do know about depression is that people do respond to placebo treatments in trials of antidepressants. And there's even an interesting study, a series of studies done at Columbia University by some of my former colleagues that demonstrate that if you are given a treatment that enhances your expectation that you're going to benefit, then there is a measurable clinical benefit of that. So you can be given a placebo treatment and really experience a clinical benefit. And what that means to me is that, you know, it means that there are things that you can do to help yourself. And I think depression really is a lot about your feelings and about the circumstances of your life and about how in control and out of control you feel and how you respond to the particular circumstances that you're faced with. And so, you know, I think we're all sort of very courageous for just being here and living. And, you know, so acknowledging that can also help. So I think that there are things we can do.
I think one of the things about that strikes me about placebo and depression, you know, my guest earlier in the show, John Kelly, said he wondered if there would be only a short-term effect of placebos, if it wouldn't work long-term. But I'm thinking about placebos and depression, and if you get a short-term effect, even just a short-term effect, then that opens the door. Because, you know, if you get a short-term lifting of the depression, it opens the door to give someone motivation to do aerobic exercise or start meditation or really engage in psychotherapy to begin to open up some doors in your mind and in your heart. So, you know, short term could be very effective in changing the way the brain functions.
Another very interesting series of studies on depression compares antidepressant treatment with cognitive behavioral therapy. And these studies were done by a group of people, including Steve Holland and company at Vanderbilt. And what they find is that cognitive behavioral therapy lasts substantially longer than antidepressant treatment. So if you're on antidepressants and you go off antidepressants, then you tend to get worse. And if you're on cognitive behavioral therapy, you do quite a bit better a year or more out.
I want to take a look at expectations and the pharmaceutical studies that, you know, we've been reading for time in memoriam. If we look at the findings, then it's right to question the validity of these outcome studies, because patients are sent out, are given the medication, and told to expect a positive outcome, in effect.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's, in a weird way, a bit of good news, in that, you know, when we're running trials, whether it's on antidepressants or it's on some other medication for another problem, it's done under these conditions that are called double-blind or randomized control trials, where no one really knows what's going on. And am I getting the medication, am I not, as a participant in the trial? And then in the real world, we have essentially the benefit of, yes, I know I'm taking an active medication, and so our expectations may be energized in those circumstances, and we may be able to get larger effects and for, you know, for people's benefit.
So let's, in the minute we have left, Tor, tell us about the implications for medical training, pharmaceutical research.
Well, I think the implications, some of the implications are that clinical trials and medical treatment hasn't had a formal way of taking into account ideas about expectations and beliefs in the patient's psychology, even though many physicians, almost all physicians, really acknowledge that the person's psychology plays a large role. There hasn't been a place, you know, for that in clinical trials. And what we're seeing now is that expectations, positive expectations, can induce opioid release in the brain and dopamine release in the brain and can have pharmacological effects on the brain.
Yeah, and
so I think what we need to do is study how that works.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. Gentlemen, I want to thank you for your research. Thanks for taking the time to join us. It's really been a fascinating discussion.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Yeah, it was great. My guests have been Tor Wager and Guy Montgomery. Tor is a researcher at University of Colorado's Department of Psychology and Neuroscience. Guy is the director of the Integrative Behavioral Medicine Program at Mount Sinai. Earlier on, we heard from John Kelly, one of the authors of the Harvard study on open placebos. Next week, we're going to hear from author Stephanie Kuntz. She's written about the long-term impact of the feminine mystique. Well, you can reach us at voices@whyy.org. I'm at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Kevin Griffin. Thanks, Kevin. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is the executive producer of audio content. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn is our producer. Emily Haas is our intern. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Enjoy your week, my friends.
And you're listening to WHYY-FM Philadelphia. I'm Susan Palenko here with Tanya English. And this is your opportunity right now to show your support for Voices in the Family, show your support for Dr. Dan Gottlieb and WHYY. We have a mini goal this break to hear from 20 avid fans of Dan or listeners who become members. It's all about you. You can make it happen. You can go to whyy.org and pledge online, or you can give us a call, 1-888-345-9499. Do it now. Do not procrastinate any longer.
This is a little bit of a rare request for me. I'm a health reporter, and writing is definitely my strong suit, but I want people to do a little bit of math. Think about how much time you spend with 91FM. Is it a little bit more than you spend with your TV channels? There's kind of an intuitive calculus that we do about what public media, how much we value that. Think about that. Do the math yourself. And whatever number you come up with, give us a call. The number is 888-345-9499. And give us a call and contribute, 888-345-9499.
And we have a wonderful group of volunteers here from Drexel University Undergraduate Television Management Program and the Friends of WHYY in Chester County 911. Now, we're happy to feed them from Divan Turkish Kitchen right here. And these are all good examples of people who come together and help support WHYY in our effort in our winter membership campaign. But now it's your turn. Now it's your time. Now it's time for you to put your dollars where your ears are and to support the kind of listening that you've been enjoying. And since you're tuned in, you must value this, but now is the time to take action. 1-888-345-9499. I know that we have lots of listeners out there who are very dedicated Dan fans, and I would then now invite you to